This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Mike. And are there any vice-chancellors in the... Oh, good, right. I always feel a sense of relief because I'm still getting threatening letters from them after our report in the summer. But first of all, thank you very much indeed for inviting me to speak this afternoon. And I want to really sort of address, on behalf of my committee, which was then the Innovation University Science and Skills Select Committee, our report on students and universities, which we published on the 2nd of August this year. Now, in my experience, select committee reports fall into several categories. Those that sink without trace the moment they're published and people say, oh, wasn't that nice, and then put them on the shelves. Those that explode like a firework and then are quickly forgotten. And those like this report, which have got a slow burn and continues to burn. And continues to be talked about. And I have to say that in terms of a response to a select committee report, it's about the 15th that I've done as chairman of various committees, and it's the one that's got the most polarised debate going in terms of those who thought it was the best report they'd ever read and those who thought it was the worst report and, you know, we should be thrown in the Thames as a result. But the Students and Universities Report has contributed to a debate which is going to run and run and run and will gather momentum as the fees reviews gets underway. It's convenient, of course, that the fees review will now not report until after the general election, a device which was used in 97, as you know, with the Deering report that was there. And, of course, it is also a report and an issue which is going to run in the face of the public sector funding crisis. Now, we wanted our report to be about students. This was about students and universities. And we wanted the product, we wanted to talk about the product which they were receiving in the UK university sector. And I have to say that the students, both the National Union of Students, who were incredibly cooperative and supportive in terms of presenting evidence to the committee, but particularly the students we met individually up and down the country and different parts of the United Kingdom, were an absolute pleasure to deal with. And their evidence was relevant, it was concise, it was firmly grounded in their own experiences of life at university today. But by contrast, the higher education establishment, or those parts we encountered, were largely defensive, reluctant to engage on many of the issues, and gave the impression that Parliament had no right to question the product being delivered. I'll go before you have a chance to attack me on that. But let me explain that we had absolutely no intention of simply undermining what I and my committee believe to be a world-class higher education system. But given the rapid changes that were happening in and outside of government, we wanted to add to the growing debate about the role of higher education in the 21st century, and in particular, the role of higher education in the post-recession 21st century economy. Our inquiry began in the autumn of 2008. This is just to frighten you. It's there for no other purpose. But it began long before Lord Mandelson's empire was created and swallowed up the Department of Innovation, Universities and Skills, indeed, most other things. It was interesting that even at the Queen's speech yesterday, Lord Mandelson appeared with the Queen. So I don't know what his next move is. But anyhow, Charles, watch out. Dias had taken over responsibility for higher education. And of course, in that move from education and skills, department going into Dias, and was spending virtually half its budget, £8 billion, on higher education. And it was inevitable, therefore, that government rightly looks at the product and what it was doing. And of course, in 2008... such a nice man, isn't he, anyhow. In 2008, the then Secretary of State at Dias, John Denham, said, that he was, and I quote, developing a framework for higher education for the next 15 years, and he was keen on posing the big question. The big question is, how do we ensure that our university system is world-class in 15 years' time? Well, I make light of many ministerial statements and ministerial initiatives, but I actually think that was the most fundamental issue which needed to be addressed, and quite frankly, still needs to be addressed. And as a committee, we'd already done a great deal of work on skills following the Lord Leech's review of skills and the ambitious targets that were set for the expansion of higher education. Not the 50% target, which Tony Blair set, but the one that Lord Leech set, which was 40% of adults skilled to graduate level and above by 2020, up from 29% in 2005. That is the most incredibly challenging target, given that some 70% of those 2020 adults are already or were already in the workplace. And that is the key thing and one of the key challenges for the higher education sector. So we wanted to see how the rapid move to a mass higher education market was affecting universities and the quality of student life. And we wanted to address two concerns that were featuring in the media: standards and the widening participation for lower socioeconomic groups. You may well recall a stand-up rows between John Denham and Lord Patton, the Chancellor of Oxford University, about admissions to universities. I actually think those rows are good. I think they're actually what we should be having, you know, in terms of the sector. But our inquiry started to take evidence. We've never had as many written submissions to any inquiry that we've done. 122, all published on the internet. Admissions were of excellent quality by and large, and ranged from one side to 56 pages, courtesy of the Russell Group. Unfortunately, as this was an inquiry about students, other than the National Union of Students, who gave us an excellent submission, only two student unions and only two students, individual students themselves, submitted evidence to the inquiry. And that was a worry, and it led the committee to look for alternative ways of engaging students themselves. So we got out and about and visited universities and took oral evidence on the record at Liverpool Hope, where we looked at met students from all the three Liverpool universities and their vice-chancellors, at Oxford Brookes, where we met the vice-chancellors of Oxford and Oxford Brookes. That was an interesting encounter. And Imperial College, where we also met the rector of Imperial, which was an equally interesting experience. But in all three of those locations, the really sort of impressive part of those inquiries was the students themselves. Really quite fantastically grounded young men and women who were able to really engage with the committee. So we spoke to 70 witnesses formally, 29 of whom were students. We had a student panel of four students who looked at the evidence and in fact came back to review it in April. And we also ran an e-consultation from February to April, which received about 200 posts. This, in my view, was undoubtedly a thorough inquiry with a considerable body of evidence, though it lacked, and this sector lacks, which is quite ironic, high-quality social science research on many of the key areas of discussion. Actually getting evidence to prove your case one way or another in higher education is incredibly difficult, and it is a challenge to the sector, and more of that later. To say the response to the report has been mixed is an understatement. But what was of concern to me was that much of the reaction, particularly from the establishment, was predictable. And even more worrying, it was focused on rubbishing the messenger rather than addressing the issues we raised. And I think that that is a challenge for the sector, and it's a challenge for those of you here today who are involved with enhancing the student experience. And I know many of you are directly and passionately involved in that area. So first on admissions and the information available to prospective students. We found the practice varied across the sector. We did not call for a common admissions process or for government to specify the actual admissions and selection rules. That would be ridiculous. But given the diversity of higher education institutions, 133 in England, we concluded that the sector should have arrangements that reduce the elements of randomness and chance in the system and helped ensure students got a fairer deal, and therefore a code of practice across institutions was what we called for. We concluded that universities should present information available to prospective students in a consistent format to allow easy comparison. And it should cover in time a typical undergraduate student should expect, what he should expect or she should expect in attending lectures, tutorials in personal study, and for science courses, how much laboratory time each week that they would receive. Universities, we believe, should indicate the likely size of tutorial groups, the numbers of lectures, and the extent to which students may be taught by graduate students. And in fact, talking to mature students who, again, going back to those Leach targets of 40% by 2020, one student said to us that getting a clear idea of the hours involved and when lectures would be was incredibly important to me because of my childcare responsibilities. Well, by response, the government said it did not believe the process should be led centrally. Universities UK, not surprisingly, took exactly the same view. And throughout the response from government and from Universities UK, and indeed from some of the university organisations, was this view that we were attacking university autonomy. And the point here, which neither the government nor Universities UK addressed, was whether university autonomy should trump the needs of the student. In our view, it should not. And we call for a debate on the boundaries of university autonomy. And we ought to have that debate. Now, let me make it clear that we were not talking here about a threat to academic freedom or any restraint on academic freedom at all. What we were talking about was organisational autonomy. What worked 200 years ago, when we'd only two universities in England, with a small student population drawn from one social class with no state support, may not work today with 2 million students. Now, I'm not sure that much organisational autonomy now exists in practice. As one Vice-Chancellor pointed out to the committee, universities are subject to many regulatory controls and they're heavily dependent on the state for direction and support. Now, I would prefer that we dropped the pretense, if that is indeed all it is, because it obscures accountability and I think the needs of the student population. On information for prospective students, the government responded very positively to our report and agreed that it would be helpful for prospective students to have access to better information about student life and student workloads. And it's asked HEFCE to examine the issues in consultation with the sector. Universities UK appear to see little need for change. The problem it saw was that more might be done, and I quote, to help prospective students understand the amount and type of contact which will constitute their higher education programme. Well, in other words, the information was there, but it was up for stupid prospective students to find it. Now, the second area I want to cover is the treatment of part-time and mature students. The failure of the current system to treat them on the same basis as full-time students is in effect a form of discrimination. This is not only wrong, but it also militates against the Leach target of 40% for all adults in England getting a higher education qualification by 2020. The committee recommended that the forthcoming review of fees examine all aspects of support for part-time and mature students, and that a deadline be set by which the treatment of and support for full-time and part-time undergraduate students becomes broadly similar. Not a word about that in the media coverage of our report, not a word from ministers, from Universities UK or any other organisation apart from the National Union of Students, who supported very strongly those sentiments. Indeed, the government's response was po-faced. It said, and I quote, "We will not preempt the work of the Independent Commission by commenting on possible levels of fees." We weren't asking for that. What we were asking for was the creation of a level playing field. And until we achieve that for part-time and mature students, we will not have a wholly inclusive higher education system based on equality. And we found that incredibly disappointing. We went on to consider then the quality of teaching to undergraduates. Our e-consultation and the oral evidence given from students revealed wider criticism of the quality of teaching than I certainly had expected. Student views ran the full gamut from the complimentary to the critical. And here's an example of the critical. And I quote, "University lecturers seriously need to take lessons from school teachers on how to teach. They are clever, but they are not skilled at conveying that message." Amongst the conclusions and recommendations we reached in this area were that, first, the government and the higher education sector should establish arrangements applicable across the sector which would allow students to convey concerns about poor teaching and ensure that universities take effective action. Secondly, that the government should require higher education institutions as a condition of support from the taxpayer to have in place programmes to enhance the teaching effectiveness of all academic staff, and that there should be a review of the use or abuse of graduate students to teach, a concern raised by many students. The government's response could be summarised as a qualified no to most of our recommendations on teaching. But we've begun that debate, and it is important that that debate actually continues. And though the government has made money available to universities to improve teaching and said that it believes that higher education institutions are responsible for ensuring their staff hold appropriate qualifications and have opportunities for development and training, I, for one, am not going to hold my breath that when the financial squeeze comes on the higher education sector, that teaching will once again slip further down the pecking order. It must not. The student experience is fundamental in terms of teaching. So on mechanisms to convey students' concerns about poor teaching, we got a flat rejection. The government said that there were sufficient processes in place, in exactly the same way as it said there were sufficient processes to deal with academics' concerns about standards within their particular faculties. Universities UK accepted none of our criticisms either. Teaching is perfect in all universities, by all staff, to all students. And it said in its response, Gavin, I'm getting quite cynical about this. But as I'm leaving at the next parliament, I can say what I like. It said in its response, in our experience, quote, criticism, and I thought this was wonderful. Universities UK said, in our experience, criticism of the quality of teaching and standards tends to be isolated and anecdotal. The UUK anecdotally criticising the criticisms for being only anecdotal. Only a university organisation could actually do that. It's absolutely priceless. So you see why I'm sceptical about Hefke's approaches are going to get anywhere. A fourth area I wish to touch on briefly is the thorny question of tuition fees. We deliberately did not review fees, and we made no recommendations to the level at which variable tuition fees should be capped or whether they should be abolished. It's too early for that, and that wasn't our remit. But tuition fees came up at several points during the inquiry, and we set out observations to inform the review rather than, in fact, to have a position. We did not receive, and I was surprised at this, significant comment that people may have been discouraged from applying to university because of fees, though some expressed a view that a steep rise in fees might deter full-time students from applying. Nor did we detect, and this was really quite important, that variable tuition fees at current levels were driving up quality on campus. This is not surprising, given that the fees hardly vary across the higher education sector and so provide little incentive for students to look for value for money between institutions. Clearly, there is a need for good evidence here, which is why we recommended that in its consultation on the review of fees, the government commission and publishers independent research to provide for a detailed and informed debate, in particular into the impact of a higher cap on course quality and applications. I think that's quite reasonable to do. And we believe that the level of debt a student could reasonably be expected to incur has to be a central question for the forthcoming review of fees. And without it, it's deeply flawed. We did look at the current bursary system and concluded that the existing bursary arrangements were unsatisfactory, and we supported the NUS view about a national bursary system. Students from identical backgrounds with the same financial need for support receive significantly varying bursaries depending on which university they attend. And the more prestigious, in inverted commas, the university, the more money, perversely, they actually have to spend on bursaries. A national system calculated on need, we believed, would widen the participation of disadvantaged groups in higher education, though we made no comment about the levels of bursaries themselves. Disappointingly, while not prejudicing review, the government made it clear it did not support a national bursary scheme, as of course did the Universities UK. So let me finally turn to this issue of standards. It has generated much heat in the media, though not as much light as I would have liked. We found that the system in England for safeguarding consistent national degree standards in higher education institutions is out of date, is inadequate, and is in urgent need of replacement. The current arrangements, with each university responsible for its own standards, are no longer meeting the needs of a mass higher education system in the 21st century. One statistic sticks out like a sore thumb. The proportion of first-class and upper-second-class honours degrees has increased steadily over the past 15 years. For example, the proportion of first-degree students, undergraduates receiving... Sorry, don't get excited. The proportion of first-degree students receiving a first-class honours has gone up from 7.7% in 6-7 to 13.3% in 7-8. Now, there may be excellent reasons for this. Better teaching, students work harder now than ever before, they arrive at universities with larger brains than ever before, or perhaps universities are inflating marks to keep their positions in the league tables. Good heavens, no. I hope it's the former, not the latter. But what the committee found was no appetite whatsoever to investigate the reasons for that rise. What is exposed was an absence of evidence to provide answers to these key questions and a reluctance to monitor, let alone enforce, standards across the sector. First, different levels of effort were required in different universities to obtain degrees in similar subjects, which might suggest that different standards may be being applied, but we don't know. Second, we came across some pointers that students in England spend significantly less time studying than their counterparts overseas. Our visit to the US tended to confirm this, and we call for research on both points because we just do not know, nor does the sector. We were concerned that universities retain international competitiveness and that standards are crucially important to our universities retaining that overseas market. But when pressed, Vice Chancellor stated that as international students continue to apply to our universities, standards must be satisfactory. The committee was strongly of the view that it is absurd and disreputable to justify academic standards with a market mechanism. Finally, the committee had concerns about the body that currently assures quality, the QAA. It focuses almost exclusively on process and not standards. So we call for the QAA to be transferred into an independent quality and standards agency with a remit to safeguard, monitor, and report on standards. We did not call for an Ofsted. Heavens above, as an ex-head teacher, Ofsted is the last thing that I would ever want to have. We might even get, you know, Woodhead backers. And no, we mustn't go. Sorry, Mike, it was awful. It will not come as a surprise when I tell you that neither the government nor the Universities UK accepted our main recommendations on standard. What did sadden me was that they advanced nothing new or showed any inclination to engage with our concerns. The only area where there was any movement was a review of external examiners by HEFCE, which might see some boost to external scrutiny of standards. We need to have consistent practices and standards across higher education to hold the sector together. And if our solution isn't the right one, fair enough, let's at least look at it. If an undergraduate works hard and achieves a good degree, it should mean that he has reached the same intellectual development, capacity, skill, irrespective of the university attended. And I believe in all our universities, you will find students with that same intellectual capacity delivering the same intellectual standards. The challenge for the next decade for the higher education sector will to be to develop consistency in practice and standards and much greater openness and transparency so that when these children go off to university in 6 or 7 or 8 years' time, I don't know how old they are, our university sector still remains world-class, still remains competitive against the emerging nations of the world, and still produces, as it does now, the highest levels of intellectual standards that you can find anywhere in the world. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Phil, and without doubt the finest illustrations we've had so far in our presentations. Now, we are running a little bit over, so I'm afraid it's going to have to be a pretty brief question session, but if you get your hands up quickly, I can take one or two, but I'm afraid then we need to move on. So, gentlemen over there on the aisle, if we can get the microphone over there, please, and I'll take gentlemen here in the middle as well. Thank you very much. And can I stress, can we have brief questions, please? Thank you. Yeah. If you wouldn't mind standing up, just letting know your name and where you're from.
Paul Glennon, Burnham City University. I welcome the any focus on student experience, and the NSS, National Student Survey, does this. However, are there negatives attached to the survey that perhaps lead to division, an overemphasis on number crunching and league table climbing that counteract collaboration and proactive getting on with what it is we're meant to do and delivering our service?
Okay, thanks. So negative aspects of the National Student Survey.
I actually think the National Student Survey is a good starting point. What it isn't is the whole picture. And what is required is within every institution the ability, and I think most universities actually do this, but they do it in a much more informal way, is start to actually engage. What is the real experience students are having? You know, what is the quality of that experience? And how, in fact, do they deal with with the inadequacies of it? I mean, I was at Queen's University on Tuesday of this week, again, talking to students who were immensely complimentary about, these were freshers, of the work they were doing. But it was feedback from lecturers that they were all, because they're used to that when they're in school, and suddenly they found that they weren't getting any feedback at all, and they were a bit lost. Now, you ought to be able to have mechanisms to be able to deal with that, because I think that's just a very simple point.
Thank you. And gentlemen just there, thanks.
University of Surrey Union. Phil, do you think there are too many universities?
Where are you?
Yeah, do you mind standing up?
Sorry.
Do you mind standing up? We can see you there.
Yeah.
Do you think there are too many universities?
Oh.
good left field question.
Oh, heck. No, I actually don't. I think that what we have, and interestingly, I'm just rewinding now. There are real issues about whether, in fact, we can sustain 133 higher education institutions which are basically comprehensive universities. I think there is a real challenge there. And that's why John Denham's review, if it had been taken seriously, was hugely important. And I think all of us should have actually engaged with that. There is a real debate to be had about research concentration. The new REF, you know, which is looking at impact of research, again, opens up a whole new world for our universities. But in terms of undergraduate teaching, I actually think that we need to have a broad-based sector which enables students to, wherever possible, have the choice of being able to study locally as well as having to go away. So, no, I don't. But quality is the key. And if they can't maintain quality, then, quite frankly, they shouldn't be there.
Okay. Sadly, time is against us for any more questions, but thank you very much indeed, Phil. Can we just show appreciation to Phil Williams?